I think that many of us have spent the last few months thinking a lot about language. Perhaps not consciously, but still. The news, the rumors, the instructions from authorities, private and not so private interactions in social media. None of this could have been shared and discussed without linguistic interaction. The current situation has brought about not just new ways of communicating, but also new vocabularies. Social distancing has led to digi-hugs and corona cancellations to e-meetings, all words that were not frequently used before, at least not by me. As we were planning the theme of this autumn's lecture series, we had no idea that we would have to give the lectures in Zoom. Zoom was not even part of my everyday life before March, perhaps not of yours either. But it means, I think, that our way of thinking about both language and communication has changed just over the past 6 or 7 months, and I feel that these autumn lectures are more relevant than ever. Because it's not just a question of new vocabularies or finding digital channels to communicate when you can't meet in person. More importantly, the current situation has brought to the fore the crucial function of language as something truly powerful. Not just in the propaganda sense or the conscious attempts to affect how people feel or think, but even more so in the less notable changes that sort of sneak up on us and then have suddenly become part of the general language of our countries or even of our own. This summer, I listened to a radio program where someone cited the famous phrase, "Words can be like tiny doses of arsenic." It's a fairly popular quote, the context of which is often not taken into account. It was coined by the journalist and philologist Viktor Klemperer in his study of the function of language in Nazi Germany. Lingua tertiae imperie, Notizbuch eines Philologe, a philologist's notebook, published in 1947. I'd like to quote the entire passage to which the famous arsenic quote belongs because I think it expresses the workings of language in such a precise way. "The most powerful influence," writes Klemperer, "was exerted neither by individual speeches nor by articles or flyers, posters or flags. It was not achieved by things which one had to absorb by conscious thought or conscious emotions. Instead, Nazism permeated the flesh and blood of the people through single words, idioms, and sentence structures, which were imposed on them in a million repetitions and taken on board mechanically and unconsciously." A little further below, he continues, "Language does not simply write and think for me. It also increasingly dictates my feelings and governs my entire spiritual being, the more unquestioningly and unconsciously I abandon myself to it. And what happens if the cultivated language is made up of poisonous elements or has been made the bearer of poisons? Words can be like tiny doses of arsenic. They are swallowed unnoticed, appear to have no effect, and then after a little time, the toxic reaction sets in after all." The current situation in the world, an unfortunate combination of authoritarian leaders who accuse their opponents of spreading fake news and a pandemic that in some cases offers an excuse to abandon democratic principles and basic human rights. This situation in which we now live makes these words by Klemperer highly relevant. Language is even more influential when we are isolated from each other, so we need to think carefully of its significance and the power it exerts. When I went to high school, I had a teacher who completely changed my way of thinking about language. It may sound drastic, but I think he even changed the way in which I thought one could change or influence one's life. Joachim Dürken was a German gentleman in his early 60s who, for obscure reasons, had ended up in the Swedish countryside. He had one PhD in French and another doctorate degree in law, but he was teaching German and French in a mediocre high school on the Swedish west coast. I studied French. And Monsieur Durkheim, as we had to address him, was obese, incredibly strict, and all students were terrified of him. I thought he was amazing. I was probably as scared as anyone else, but there was something about the way in which he took us seriously, as if French grammar really mattered, that language was not something you learned just because, but that we also had to understand why. "You have to learn languages," he would yell at us in his heavy German accent. "You have to learn languages because that's how you learn savoir-faire." No one had ever mentioned savoir-faire to me in school, so I had to look it up in order to understand what he meant. Back then, I probably thought that savoir-faire meant that I could speak French well enough to become au pair girl in France after school. My perspectives were not very wide. Now I know that it's much more than being able to speak with a reasonable accent and buy the right kind of cheese. What Monsieur Durkheim meant, I think, is that language helps us to handle the world in relation to ourselves. Not just to behave in a certain manner, but to analyze and hopefully also understand ourselves and our surroundings. I also think that Monsieur Durkheim knew very well that this is not just about communication, but about the capacity of language to help us think in abstract terms, to be able to define the subject, the predicate, and the different objects of a sentence is not just about grammar, but also understanding the relation between different agents and individuals and place them in a meaningful context. I didn't know back then that I would become a philologist and spend my life working with languages. I just enjoyed so much learning new languages because it opened up new worlds that I hadn't been able to imagine. I took any chance learning another one. And that's how I came to learn ancient Greek, which opened up new worlds not only geographically and culturally, but also a whole series of worlds in the past, from antiquity till today. These kind of worlds, cultural and political, literary and historical, are at the focus of our lectures this autumn. Obviously, this particular part of the world, Istanbul, Asia Minor and Anatolia, offers a perfect vantage point for thinking about languages and communication because it has been a crossroad of cultures and people for millennia and still is. That means a multitude of languages and a multitude of voices, endless stories and a never-ending series of connections between peoples and places. Anu Leinonen from the Finnish Institute in the Middle East in Beirut will open the series with a talk on one of the persistent voices of the region, namely that of the Kurds. Anu studies the ongoing language shift from Kurdish to Turkish, focusing on both the linguistic and political aspects of such a shift. We will then turn our attention to the Turkish language and the way it is used by speakers outside of Turkey, as Mehmet Aktürk Drake of Uppsala University introduces us to the issue of bilingualism among second-generation Turks in Western European countries. How does integration impact that situation, asks Mehmet. Next in our series is not a talk, but a panel discussion, as we gather a poet, a linguist, a journalist, and a historian to discuss the potential of language and the importance of communication. We're very pleased to have as our guests Atena Farrokhzad and Helena Banisoraka from Sweden, meeting with Yasemin Çongar and Tolga Jora from Istanbul. This is part of the Dialoglar series that we are organizing in collaboration with the Swedish Consulate General. After that, two more talks await. Our Istanbul colleague, Haris Theodorelis Rigas, will turn to yet another important language of the region, namely Greek, but also to multilingualism as an important feature of the city in the 18th and 19th centuries. The work Constantinias by patriarch scholar Constantios I was first published in archaic Greek, but translated into French, Ottoman Turkish, Karamanlidika and English, a range of languages characteristic of the time. Last but not least, Jenny Wallensten, who is the director of the Swedish Institute in Athens, will take us back in time and talk to us about ancient inscriptions, the place where language, message and materiality truly meet and work together. Regardless of time and place, Words and voices of other people reach us and affect us in various ways. Language offers us the opportunity to express our identity, to define ourselves as an I, as part of a we, and sometimes in relation to them or the others, the object that we from our individual point of view can see or hear, but never fully become part of. Our relation to them may not be very different from our relation to the past. A language can help us understand people in another place, but it can also help us interpret historical situation through a language that is no longer in use. In both cases, we need interpretation. There's no direct link through the language to either Kurdish culture or ancient Greece. But knowing languages, modern as well as historical, offers the possibility of cross-cultural understanding, while at the same time training us to think in abstract terms and handle large sets of data. These are important skills in a global world with an increasing demand on communication and problem solving. So linguistic competence is something wonderful. Languages are good to think with because they help us structure the world, then as now.